Think about this, beloved listeners. Since the election was won by Biden, only 25 Republicans in Congress have been willing to agree that he actually won. Two continue to state that Trump won, and another 222 are afraid to answer. But as the coronavirus cases continue to rise in the US, it looks like a serious pandemic response will take up much of the energy of the incoming administration. David Frum's latest book, Trumpocalypse, Restoring American Democracy, focuses on what a Biden administration needs to address. And he argues that the reason the US was so vulnerable to a demagogue like Trump was precisely because of a long backlog of the important has again and again been overwhelmed by the urgent. To look at the challenges facing the Republican Party, the next step forward for a Biden presidency, we're delighted to welcome David Frum back. David, of course, former personal advisor to W and senior editor at the Atlantic magazine. David, you must still be bemused or shocked by the ongoing nonsense.
Well, I keep saying it would be sinister if it were not so pathetic. It would be pathetic if it were not so sinister. But here's some good news. As you said, the news on the stance of Republicans in Congress is dismaying and disturbing. But in where it counts, again and again, Trump has not been able to find allies. And just this evening, just a few minutes ago, the governor of the state of Georgia, this is a very conservative, very pro-Trump Republican governor of the state of Georgia, he issued a statement in which he said that the General Assembly cannot the Georgia legislature cannot change or overturn the electors in this state if they are elected by the popular vote on the proper day. That proper day happened. That vote has been certified twice. Talk of doing that, which the president has been doing, is simply unlawful and unconstitutional. And today, the Supreme Court rebuffed the 50th of Donald Trump's 50 in a row losing lawsuits. The walls are closing in on him.
Just been rereading one of your tweets, which refers to the fact that no vaccine CEO attended the White House event, the so-called COVID vaccine summit. And you say it's because they were fearful that Trump would try to conscript them into schemes to overturn the election.
Well, at this event today, Donald Trump launched into another one of his flights of fancy about how he was the real winner, how he was cheated, how somebody, anybody needs to save him. And of course, if you are the CEO of Pfizer or Moderna, you don't want to be there for that. And they declined to come.
In Trumpocalypse, you note that every step of the way, Trump has acted as if guided by one rule. How can I make this trauma worse?
Yes, the COVID trauma. Trump seems to have treated COVID as like a tiny microscopic personal critic, something impertinent and insulting. And if he can only ignore it, it will go away. And so you see around him, person after person succumb to the disease because he has made it a test of loyalty that they not take precautions. Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal attorney, you know that he has been, tested positive. Just today, it was announced that President Trump's other personal attorney, a kind of slapstick figure named Jenna Ellis, she's tested positive. And in his circle, it's like a gang tattoo they have to get.
Yes, the virus has got a great sense of satire, doesn't it?
Well, it's also easily defeated. It is remarkable how I think literally nobody in the Biden inner circle has got it, because as you all know, and Australia's had a good record in recent months, we don't have medical control of this thing yet, but there are precautions people can take, sensible people can take, that really reduce your odds. And if all of us who have an opportunity to take them, we can protect everybody, including the people who are more at risk.
Now, although the Donald has spent most of his time golfing, his administration has been busy pushing through policy changes. Well, for example, making the citizenship test longer and more difficult, rushing off to auction drilling rights in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Will this make it harder for Biden to undo some of the changes?
Some of the things will be hard to undo, but anything that done by an executive order can be undone by an executive order. What we're also going to discover is that 4 years is a long time in the life of a country, and that a lot of things have happened, and not all of them have been bad. I mean, there will be things that Donald Trump has done, or the Trump administration has done, that Biden will not want to do, and I can think of a couple. For example, when Donald Trump took office, the vaping industry was effectively unregulated, and they were marketing to teenagers. And not him and not anybody in his immediate vicinity, but somebody in his administration did do a crackdown and has tightened the regulation of how vaping can be advertised. And that's a good thing, that is protecting a lot of young people. And I assume the Biden people will continue it. I assume they'll want to continue the progress in the Middle East toward agreements between Israel and the Gulf states. There will be things to build on. But here's the biggest danger, and friends in Australia need to pay attention to this. One of the things that should be reversed that Biden may want to keep is Trump's protectionist trade policy, that we are developing, unfortunately, in the United States, a consensus in favor of a more confrontational trade policy, confrontational not only to China but to other friends. And Biden is an advocate of Buy American policies for government procurement that don't do the United States good and certainly don't do our friends good.
In your book, you say that Trump walked through an unlocked door into the presidency. Yes. How can that doorway be made more secure, David?
That is going to be a huge challenge for the months and years ahead. It just seems to be clear that the Republican Party, my party, didn't have, we have this complicated presidential system that is all supposed to screen out imposters and frauds, and people can't be trusted with the awesome power of the presidential office. And Donald Trump right now looks like the front runner for the Republican 2024 nomination. Maybe things will change. Maybe he'll be tangled in legal or personal difficulties. But right now, Republicans are rallying to him, and he is subverting and defaming any Republican who would try to stand up and take that nomination away from him.
I remember you writing that even before Trump declared for president, the GOP had ceased to even try to represent an American majority. Speak to that.
Yes. Well, that is such an important problem, and that is the most important choice that the party faces as it looks forward. Why was Trump's scheme of flipping these state legislatures even thinkable? And the answer to that was because in at least three states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, Republicans have a majority of the seats in the state legislature, even though they got a minority of the vote. In Wisconsin, they had 45% of the vote and 65% of the seats. It can be comfortable to be in the minority in the United States. We are not a very representative political system. And you can build on that, or you can say, we're going to stop trying to thwart people from voting, stop trying to distort the vote, and go compete for the votes.
Makes it sound so elegant and simple. And, of course, one prays that you're right. If Trump had won this year, or mind-boggling, wins in 2024, what's the future for the GOP?
Well, I wrote a long essay about this for a Canadian magazine, and it's important to be precise about what you mean by saying Trump won. I mean, you could draw scenarios where Trump could convert his 46% of the vote. He got 46.1 in 2016. He got 46.9 this time. You can convert that into an electoral college majority. But there is no way to imagine that Trump would have actually won the vote outright. And so when you say what would happen if Trump won, you have to say what would happen if for the second time in a row the American political system said to the American majority, to 51% of the American people, Hillary got 48, but Biden got 51. Sorry, the system stacked against you. Your 51 doesn't count. Their 46% does. And twice in a row we have a person who lost the majority of the country, or the plurality the first time, the majority the second time. Twice he's going to be president. I think that's a formula for political instability. I don't think people are going to put up with it. And so what I worry about is not what would that presidency look like, but what would the reaction to that presidency look like?
You predict, and I'm fascinated by this, a swing to the left in the U.S. after this year. Why?
I think we're going to see government used in a lot of affirmative ways in a way it has not done. I think in many ways we're coping across the world with a period of discontent after the global financial crisis. That hit people very, very hard. The recovery was not broadly shared. And a lot, it's so far the energy from the discontent has poured into the populist right. Well, the populist right is failing. The populist right is, Donald Trump is defeated, the Brexit is not heading towards success, other similar kinds of parties are running into trouble. But that feeling of discontent that we don't have a fair world that has been so strong since 2009, that feeling is still there. And with the failure of the populist right, I think it goes to the left.
Well, you make the point that the U.S. should see wealth being taxed more heavily. And you also think that labor should be more protected and that companies and industries regulated more intrusively. Heavens above, you sound like a Democrat.
Well, I want to be clear about this, that I am someone who is very much of the right. I believe in markets. I believe in light regulation. I also think it's important to be able to read the cards in your hand. And when you have a bad hand, sometimes it's necessary to make some concessions rather than get, you know, called into oblivion. So I think there are things that I think, like in the 1930s, a better deal now can actually achieve the goal of protecting and conserving most of the system as we've got it. I mean, I am as worried as anybody, or almost as worried as anybody, by some of the extremist tendencies out there on the political left. I think if people in the United States were less fearful of their health insurance, less fearful about college, we could suck a lot of the energy out of them and make them content with a system that feels fair to them.
Do you see the U.S. being able to reclaim its position as world leader, or does it need to focus on getting the household in shape first?
Well, asserting world leadership again, which is really necessary, is going to be challenging. When I worked in the Bush administration, and that was 20 years ago, the American economy was about 8 times the size of the Chinese economy. And when Barack Obama took office, the American economy was still about 3 times the size of the Chinese economy. And now, maybe the Chinese economy, depending on the measures you use, maybe it's 65% of the U.S., maybe it's 80%, maybe it's equal. Certainly, we don't have the preponderant advantage we used to do, and that's just a fact. So if you're going to contain China and prevent them from doing some of the outrageous things they do, like their targeting of Australia, the United States is no longer big enough, and China is no longer small enough for the United States to do it alone. We need partners. And so American leadership is going to be leadership of coalitions, and not just the familiar, comfortable coalitions with Australia, New Zealand, and Great Britain, and the EU, and the NATO countries, and Japan, but new ones with India, and the Philippines, and Vietnam, and in Indonesia. And that's going to take a lot of hard diplomatic work.
I'm intrigued by your observation in Trumpocalypse that the Republican brand has cratered among every group but rural voters, white evangelicals, and white Catholics.
Yeah. Well, that's the story of this election, is that, and the 2018 election before, is that Biden piled up his votes in the areas where, I mean, if you think, what do you think of when you think of a Republican? Okay, maybe you think of the Monopoly man with the top hat and spats, but when you're less irritated, what do you think of is, think of a family in the suburbs with a nice house and, money in a retirement plan and kids in college, not the richest of the rich, but people who are more or less comfortable and suburban. That's where the Republican vote has cratered in 2018 and 2020, especially among the women. And that's something that Republicans need to take seriously. I mean, it's not a surprise that the Democrats did well, you know, in the Rio Grande Valley, and they did well in San Francisco and New York. But that's not why they did so. That's not why they won the House in 2018 and why Biden is president. They won the suburbs of Atlanta. They won the suburbs of Houston.
The last time I was looking at the vote, he did seem to do better with the Hispanics than might have been expected.
Well, there's a lot about this we don't know. Remember, a lot of the statements are relying on the exit polls, and exit polls are never good, and this year there was especially bad. Still, there is some suggestive evidence that Trump did not perform as badly with Hispanics as people thought. If he got maybe a third of the vote or a little less, he would be in line with other Republicans. And there's going to be a lot of argument about why exactly that happened, and I'm not going to try to get inside anybody's head. But let's remember, if he got 30% of the vote, that meant he didn't get 70% of the vote. The Republican coalition is not going to be based on You know, picking up some votes among Hispanics will be good, but their existential threat is their collapse among suburban women.
I was talking to Bruce Shapiro last night about the Georgia runoff. How crucial is the result of this for the future?
Well, it's immediately hugely important, because if the Democrats win both of the two seats that are up, they have effective control of the Senate. If the Republicans win even one, the Republicans keep effective control of the Senate. Now, in some ways, it won't be world historical, because even if the Democrats get the two seats and get 50, their majority will still depend on some pretty conservative Democrats like Joe Manchin from West Virginia. But it means if they win the two seats that Biden can pick whatever cabinet nominees he wants and he can get judges through, whereas if the Republicans win one, there's a lot of opportunity to obstruct. I think it also makes a difference to, will Biden be able to pass a tax plan? Will he be able to pass an environmental bill? Or will he have to rely on the president's powers of executive order?
In their most recent decisions, the Supremes have not been bent them to Trump's will. What should Biden do about the Supremes? Should he add to it? Should he, try to radicalize it in any way?
I don't think he's going to tamper with the Supreme Court, and I think it's just, and I would advise him if he asked me not to. It's just, it's too big a fight for too little payoff, especially when. It would be much less controversial and much more beneficial to them to expand the lower federal courts, which haven't been expanded. I mean, the first two levels, they're the same size as they were a generation ago, and there's just a huge new volume of federal litigation. So if he added district judges and appellate judges, he could, he could rebalance the courts and do some patronage of a kind that he probably would want to do without the horrible fight that he would get. In a fight like that, you never want to be the person who starts it. If the Supreme Court does some outrageous partisan decision, Biden may have a chance. But what they're signaling with these Trump cases is, we're a very conservative court, yes, but we're not going to listen to every crazy thing that President Donald Trump says.
Before you came on the program tonight, I've been discussing the UK and the EU, the Brexit negotiations or the collapse thereof. What does America have at stake in the foundering negotiations between those players?
I've written a lot about this for The Atlantic, and I invite people to read the articles, because I'll try to be brief. But the EU is the largest trading bloc in the world, bigger than the United States. And of course, the United States has intimate friends and allies, both in economics and security on both sides. And one of the things that has been just dismaying about the Trump years is how the United States was not exerting beneficial influence to achieve a rapid settlement. I mean, the American interest was, first, that Britain not leave. But second, once Britain leave, the American interest was that this negotiation be as rapid and as amicable as possible. And because the United States has been AWOL, that's, I think, been a contributing factor to causing this thing to drag on the way it does. And I hope that a Biden administration will lend some good offices to say, the United States would wish that Britain had stayed, but it didn't. So that's a fact. Now let's make the best of this that we can and get over the recession that is going to be coming to the UK and the EU bloc if Brexit is handled badly.
David, thank you very much. David Frum. David's made some terrific contributions to the program this year. Have a good Christmas, David, and we will speak again in the new year once Biden's been sworn in. David's book, Trumpocalypse, published now by HarperCollins.